Good morning. My name is Marilyn Scott. I'm director of the McGill School of Environment. It's my pleasure to co-chair the session and introduce our next speaker, Spencer Henson. Spencer is a professor at the Department of Food, Agricultural, and Resource Economics at the University of Guelph. He's got research experience in over 50 countries, particularly related to impacts of food safety and quality regulations and standards on developing country agri-food trade, clearly a relevant topic for this session, and a lot of experience as well with working with vulnerable groups, the implications of vulnerable groups within this context, and also experience with a wide range of international agencies.
Thank you very much. I'm one of those academics with the insight or whatever that Ron talked about, and I've never had to make a decision about raspberries from Guatemala. But what I'm going to talk about is overlaps a lot with what Ron was saying. I've taken the title of the actual session because I couldn't come up with a better one, but really what I'm talking about sort of does cut across all of the issues, food safety, trade, and international markets. And as has already been said, one of my chief concerns is the impacts that some of these issues have on developing countries. What I'm going to do, after giving you a bit of context, and Ron has already introduced you to some of these things, so I might skirt over them a bit more quickly, is I'm going to talk about food safety as a global issue, and basically argue that food safety has become essentially an issue that at its core has great global interdependencies. I'm going to talk a bit about the responses to that, and again Ron talked a little bit about some of those, and particularly to talk about some of the trade and related impacts that mean that what we do on food safety can have very significant socioeconomic impacts, often in poorer parts of the world. And so what it really, the essence of it is that the safety of food here in Canada, for example, as Ron was talking about Guatemala, depends on what happens elsewhere, many, 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 many other countries. But equally, what we do about it, the controls we put in place, have big implications for the countries where that food actually comes from and the people engaged in the production of that food. So that's sort of at the core. Now, if we look at food safety, and I'm not a food safety person per se. I've studied a bit of science in the past, but I'm, I can say, unfortunately, an economist. But anyway, I'm an economist who studies food safety. What we know is that the scope and nature of food safety controls have been changing, and changing increasingly rapidly, particularly in industrialized countries, but also globally, driven by all sorts of things, our fears about food, changes in what we eat, globalization of food supply chains, trade, and all the rest of it, scientific understanding, etc. That's been driving a process, and whereas we used to see food safety predominantly as a domestic issue, a lot of regulators tended to concentrate on regulating their domestic sector and then, of course, you know, enforcing the border, but has increasingly become a global issue, and we're recognizing those global interdependencies. And because of that, there's a lot of interest in the wider impacts that the controls that are put in place have. And of course, the big thing that we tend to be concerned about is the impact on poorer parts of the world. And that's what I'm going to sort of come to. Now, what I argue in terms of food safety as a global issue is that there are many dimensions, but two key ones are the global interdependence of food safety controls and of food safety, but also that food safety has become a major trade issue, and it's largely through that route that it has these wider socioeconomic impacts on other parts of the world. And what has driven that, I think, are a number of things, and all of these are sort of tightly interrelated with one another. But first of all, the scope of food safety controls has been widening, has been changing. So food safety controls are applied across a wide range of hazards. These have changed. We still have the ones we've always been worried about, you know, bacteria and things. We're worried about new bacteria that pose new challenges. But there are also new things coming, biohazards like aflatoxins, for example, and so on. So we have a whole raft of things that worry us about food and the safety of food. And of course, as these things change, they begin to, or they enhance this global interdependency. So we know about E. coli on leafy greens, okay? But if you're concerned about things like E. coli, perhaps on sugar snap peas, because you're not going to cook them, you're going to have them in a salad, then what happens in China matters, or what happens in Guatemala matters. If you're interested in aflatoxins, well, that's a major issue if products are coming from tropical or subtropical countries. So what happens in Bolivia in production of nuts, for example, matters. And so the hazards we're concerned about has an impact. Related to that, and also changes in the sort of advancements in the economics of food safety and also the science of food safety, there have been changes in the way we go about controlling it. In the past, what we tended to do was set standards for end products. End products couldn't have more than a certain number of bacteria, and that's essentially how we used to regulate. Then over time, we've essentially put it... Oops, this is my interactive presentation. So we have initial product focus. More recently, there's been a movement to process. That is, what happens to food in its production and in its processing. So milk has to be pasteurized, for example. We say that you have to have risk-based controls like HACCP in place. And we've gone down that route. And then now we're in a world where we have a system-type focus progressively. We worry about everything that's happening in the whole chain, about issues to do with traceability, etc. So we're worried about producers, maybe in Guatemala, and maybe then products end up in a US processor, and then in a Canadian processor, and then in a Canadian retailer, and then we eat them. Okay? And so this system is integrating, and it's concentrating on all these different elements. Obviously, there's increasing trade. Robert talked a bit about this. We all have this sort of chart showing an increase in value of agri-food exports. But what that means underneath that is really that what we have is a lot of challenges for regulating. So if, for example, you're Canada, Canada in 2008 imported food from 198 countries. And 60 or so, the exports were up to $100 million. Okay, so that's, you know, on a day-to-day basis what trade means. And at the same time, these systems have got globalized. And I always like this one. It's a bit like Ron was talking about. This was put together by the National Center for Food Protection and Defense in the US. And it basically shows, this is a chicken sandwich, which you may not want to eat, but that's for different reasons. And the ingredients here were estimated to come from 36 different countries. Okay, in that one product. All sorts of things, herbs, spices and whatever, the honey that goes into the barn and so on. The global nature of agri-food systems really brings about the interdependencies, okay, in terms of food safety. So we have a big challenge. What's been the response? Well, the response has been, well, we've put more money into food safety controls, in particular into enforcement. Okay, that's maybe one reaction that we can have. But at the same time, we've tried to put better systems in place. And predominantly what that has meant is that we've moved sort of down the supply chain. So what we've done is, instead of just checking things on the market here, enforcing the border, checking things as they come in, increasingly there are things like we inspect facilities in the exporting country, we may require the exporting country to itself have a regulatory system, and the EU talk about a competent authority type of system, so that basically the methods of enforcement are moving down. Okay, so that's one sort of approach. At the same time, administrative structures have been changing. So you had things like the CFIA being created that sort of brings issues together. You've also got trade people, aid and technical assistance people, and food safety people talking to one another, which they never did in the past. We have the establishment of formal and informal international norms. Ron talked about the SPS agreement, so I can skirt over that. But also other standards, international standards. For example, ISO 22000 is a voluntary standard on food safety management systems. We also have to remember that norms and standards are established informally, for example, within the scientific community over methods of analysis. So we have a sort of global effort to try and establish norms and rules. Ron also alluded to this. The private sector has also been busy filling in gaps in regulatory systems, putting in place systems that basically provide a framework for compliance and conformity assessment in the form of private standards. So perhaps the most famous or infamous is the Global GAP standard. The Global GAP standard, originally developed by food retailers in Europe, is now having a global reach, and essentially it's a private global standard for good agricultural practice in fruit and vegetable production. And so they've filled in gaps, they've basically put in another form of regulatory system that is private in its methods of setting standards in terms of enforcement, for example, through third-party certification. What does it all mean? Well, there are very different views on this. One view is that, particularly from a developing country perspective, these basically erect barriers to trade. It basically pushes poor producers, firms, and countries out of global markets. That's one perspective. That's one of them that Ron gave, for example. Another is that actually it's a whole source of competitive advantage. It's actually the way countries can position themselves, including developing countries. Another perspective is that it's a catalyst to upgrading. In many cases, countries need to upgrade their systems, and sometimes this is a way, a sort of catalyst to that process. And then there's, of course, the protection of domestic consumers in poor countries. Not only through the controls on their own agri-food systems, but their controls on imports, including from Canada. So a lot of things going on, and actually a very complex issue, often with a lot of knee-jerk reactions, and often the impacts are far more nuanced than we can be sort of observe when we sort of first look at it. And I'm just going to give you very quickly a few examples. Egyptian groundnuts, peanuts. Huge issue. The EU very controversially brought in a very tough standard on aflatoxins. Aflatoxins are a very virulent carcinogen, naturally occurring. And basically, Egypt was one of the first countries that came up against this issue. And in effect, the EU had such onerous controls that the exports of groundnuts from Egypt into the EU collapsed. Okay. And these are the total exports of groundnuts in shell and ex-shell. If you're Egypt, you want to export the stuff out of shell because you've added more value in the country rather than having them cracked open somewhere else. And this is what happened. And you can see the period where it happened, which is basically late 90s, early 2000s. Did they have a problem? Oh, yes. This shows you the levels of aflatoxins in groundnuts in Egypt versus the EU level and the Codex level in the period we're talking about. So we're talking about 80-90% of groundnuts violated that established international norm and the EU norm. Okay? So yes, they had a problem. What has been the impact? Well, exports recovered, but they don't really export shelled groundnuts that much to the EU anymore. We've looked at the impacts in terms of trade diversion and trade reduction. There's been some trade reduction, but it's been predominantly that they export to other places and far lower value markets. They've never regained the sorts of markets that they had in the EU in the past. So this is where acted as an absolute barrier. More often, what food safety controls do is add cost. They basically reduce competitiveness of countries and firms because they get caught up at the border, or because they have to do things that they didn't do before, and more often than not, there isn't a higher price got because they do these things. It's just that you either get in to the market or you don't. Now, these are border rejections of fish and fishery products into the EU. We've done the same analysis for the US. What do we see here? There's some big exporters that have a lot of rejections. For these rejections have undoubtedly eroded competitiveness, undoubtedly. But there's also a lot of countries where there are smaller level of rejections. What's happened there? If you delve down and you actually analyze it statistically, what you find is that a lot of the times these countries benefit. They benefit from the fact that some of their big competitors are not doing very well, but they also benefit because they learn. What you find is you get a rejection in one period, that actually exports go up in the second or third period. because basically the problem's identified, and then they can take actions to actually avoid it. So things are more nuanced than you often see. Kenya, famous story. The analysis we've done, all sorts of analysis would argue Kenya wouldn't be exporting fruits and vegetables in the way it does if there weren't strict food safety requirements in place. Its problem is it has very expensive freight rates. It can't compete against Morocco and Egypt on that basis, but it can compete on the basis of food safety. And that's how it's maintained its position. So, very different views. Almost done. What about people who are actually employed, particularly poor people, in the production of these things? Been a lot of debate and a lot of accusations that strict food safety requirements have basically excluded, particularly smallholders. We've been delving into this, and we find it very difficult to find that. In fact, our statistical analysis shows exactly the opposite. Now, this is showing you exporters in sub-Saharan Africa of fresh fruits and vegetables, predominantly into Europe, between whether their customers require compliance with private standards or not, particularly global GAP. What we find is those that are actually supplying strict requirements in terms of food safety actually buy more from smallholders. Why? Because smallholders are really good at labour-intensive crops, and that's essentially what is being required here. Okay. Penultimate slide. What about the domestic food safety in countries? What's the evidence that if you enhance food safety controls for export, that it improves domestic food safety? Actually, relatively weak. In fact, there's some evidence that it diverts resources into trade away from improving domestic food safety requirements. So this is what happened with aflatoxins in groundnuts in Egypt. Oh, there seems to have been a major reduction. But if you actually look at the analysis in informal markets, groundnuts into domestic markets, you don't see commensurate reductions. These are basically the good groundnuts that are being exported, and the other stuff is being left at home. Okay, I think what we can see is a global interdependence related to food safety. Okay, what we eat depends on what happens elsewhere. The impacts are often complex and nuanced, but certainly what we do, what we require, has an impact elsewhere. We've got to avoid knee-jerk reactions, but at the same time, we need a lot deeper analysis. Okay, thanks very much.